On today's show, Alberta decides to keep its time and its taxes as referendum results come in. Election season has ended for now, and we'll discuss how much good our newly elected government should actually be doing. This is Penhold Talk Radio. And welcome to the show. My name is Brian Constantine. I'm here with my co-host, Michael Rowland.
Hello, hello.
So the referendum results have been released. Last week, the Alberta had their municipal elections, and as part of that, the province wanted our opinion on two topics. The first was on daylight savings, whether we wanted to go permanent daylight savings year-round. And the second was on equalization, whether Alberta wanted to get rid of the equalization clause from the Canadian Constitution. Now, of course, one province can't change the Canadian Constitution. So, you know, how much weight does the second one really have? I guess we'll find out, because Alberta chose in favor of removing this equalization clause. The provincial vote total, in total, there is about almost 1.1 million voters across the province who voted, at least as part of the referendum. And out of that 1.1 million, over 60% voted in favor of removing the clause, or the equalization clause, from the Canadian Constitution. So it seems like a very comfortable win, if you will, for this referendum.
Yeah, we see Penhold a little bit less of a lead. It was about 420 to 350. Then you saw the county take a decisive lead in that, with about 4,800 in favor with 1,100 against. So it
four to one.
Seems the rural area around here very much wants to scrap equalization.
Yeah, yeah. They certainly let their opinions be known there. It's a 4-1 spread on that. That's like almost 80% voted in favor of getting rid of the Constitution. So if you talk to someone in the county, you're probably talking to someone who feels that their taxes are not being handled properly at the federal level. And so this is a fairly decisive win, and I'm sure Kenny appreciates this. I wonder if he was probably a little nervous, I think, a little about this one.
Yeah, this has got to be a comforting thing, getting that support of the province, pretty decisive support that we want something done.
Yeah, and especially when you consider some of the other poll numbers and recent popularity numbers or percentages that have come out over the last few months. This was not a sure thing that people would vote in favor, but Alberta certainly has let their voice be known. And so it looks like Kenny's going to jump on this right away, and he's already going to be instituting motions in the Alberta legislature to try to get the premiers and the prime minister together to start talking about changing the equalization. Again, this whole referendum question, it's probably not going to be, it's not going to result in the equalization clause being taken out of the Constitution. There just doesn't seem like that. So this is purely a question that's going to result in a political leverage now for Alberta.
Yeah, it probably should have been worded better, because I think that was the goal all along. It was really did that show of support that Alberta wants something done. But the way it was worded, you got the impression that Alberta is going to scrap this clause in the mm-hmm. Constitution, which we can't do.
No.
So we'll see what comes of this, what Kenny can manage, what leverage he can pull in the federal level.
Now, the second referendum question was significantly closer, a lot. So remember, this was a question on whether or not Alberta should stick to daylight saving time the year round. So the same time that we are during the summer, we would keep that throughout the year. And now remember, there's 1.2 million ballots cast in the referendum. And out of those 1.1 million, the difference was just over 5,000 votes. So Penhold has a population of about 3,500. So just over the difference of Penhold's population decided this vote, whether or not the rest of the province is going to change their clocks.
One town could have swung this entire vote.
And in this case, just to be clear, the vote went negative. So Alberta decided not to change their clocks. Not to not change their clocks. Yeah. Let's put it that way. They decided to keep the back and forth, if you will. We'll still change our clocks every fall and spring, at least for now. But that was only decided by a difference of 5,000 votes. We had about 537,000 against the referendum question and 532,000 against it. 0.4% in the voting.
Yeah, just unbelievably close and remarkable considering that within the last couple of years, polls showed an extreme support for scrapping the time change and going to full daylight savings. So I think that minds have been changed recently.
They certainly seem to be, especially if that's the starting point. So it was extremely close province-wide. It was just as close here in Penhold. Again, the vote total, though Penhold actually voted slightly in favor of this. So there's more people who voted for the daylight savings position. So there were 396 votes for and 372 against. So only a difference of 24. So we have a very divided town here.
Oh, it's close. And if some of those abstainees had voted, we could have changed things.
That's right. Yeah. I'm just hopefully this does not cause a deep division within the town. We'll have to keep an eye on it, but hopefully we can move forward together. So, and I guess just as a final thought, to me, the daylight savings one was certainly, it was the more consequential one for me.
Mm-hmm.
The equalization one, sure, who knows what that might really lead to down the road. It's certainly not going to change the Constitution, especially overnight. The daylight one, though, that's going to change my, if you will, maybe speaking a little bit hyperbolically, but it changes my life 6 months out of the year.
Yeah.
It changes how I would experience my day throughout the late fall, and throughout the winter and into spring. And that was only 5,000 votes that decided that. So yeah, I think it was a very deceptively consequential vote, narrowly decided.
Yeah, and it definitely felt more significant knowing that the equalization, we knew that Alberta can't make that change, whereas this one, Alberta was committed to following the results of the referendum. So that vote, those 5,000 votes, would have affected the province. Mm-hmm. And there was no going back on that. It was going to happen.
And so now, as municipal and federal elections have wrapped up, really what we want to do for kind of the rest of this show is discuss how to evaluate in what way should we evaluate the actions of these newly elected governments. And maybe a question, or put it in kind of a different style question is, with all these campaign promises that have been made, what good is the government meant to do? What good should we be expecting them to do? And here's kind of the thesis, or here's the thought I want you to kind of keep in your mind as we kind of go through these. There's a lot of good that can be done in the world, but not all of it has to be done by the government. I think that puts it simply enough.
Seems pretty easy to understand.
Yeah. So if you can easily imagine all the good things that can be done in the world. You know, you can become a doctor, you can raise your family, you can, eat properly. All these are good things. Does the government have a say in all good things, or is the government required to be involved in facilitating or enforcing all these good things? And I think, and so that's the kind of the question. We'll go through a few articles that kind of look at perhaps where government is doing or is aimed at a good thing, but is it a good thing that the government should be doing? Or is it perhaps a good thing that other people or organizations should be responsible for? So you just before I get to the article, here's a few kind of, if you will, primers to this, kind of to set up this discussion. Bicycle helmets and seatbelts. You probably, at least the bicycle helmets you probably wore as a kid, maybe as an adult, it's maybe hit or miss, or you've changed your mind on that. Seatbelts, I think, are pretty standard now.
That's been pretty ingrained into our society for a long time. It's pretty hard to find many people that'll jump into their vehicle and drive down the highway without their seatbelt on.
Yeah, we've learned that behavior quite well, I think, most of us.
And I think we all agree it's a good idea.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a very prudent decision to make when you get in the vehicle to put your seatbelt on, or wear your helmet when you're riding your bike, or if you're maybe going around the new skate park. Yes, wear your helmet. My question, though, is this a good that the government needs to mandate, or is this a good that the government needs to enforce? Because, as I'm sure many parents out there know, the bylaw officer around town has the authority to give you a ticket, your kid a ticket, which obviously goes to you,
yeah,
to pay if your kid is not wearing his helmet or her helmet. Same with seatbelts, obviously. If you're not wearing your seatbelt, the police officer, who is an officer of the government, can ticket you for doing so. Mm-hmm. Is that a good that the government needs to be enforcing? Can we recognize this as a good, and yet separate it out from is this a good that the government needs to be mandating or punishing if it's not followed? So that's one example.
It's pretty hard to set a strict line in an issue like this. It's easy to see how it can drift into other areas. Anything that could harm the individual, a government could create a rule for. You think any dangerous activities, something simple like rock climbing, too dangerous, shouldn't be doing it,
mm-hmm.
because people could die and die a horrific death. So should the government mandate something regarding rock climbing safety?
Yep.
It's easy to see where this can go too far. Like I said, though, we've been so ingrained with the idea of helmets and seatbelts, not many people argue against the government mandating those.
Mm-hmm. We just don't give it a second thought most of the time, I don't think. Other examples, how about the local bylaws in Penhold? There are bylaws regarding how high your wheat or your weed should be in your back alley. I know, because I've received warnings about my backyard.
Yes, same here.
Now, I agree. It's a good thing to maintain your property. It's just, I think, responsible adult stewardship of your property and your belongings. But is it a good that the government needs to be mandated to enforce, or our government should be mandated? Is it a good that the government should be mandating? Is it a good that the government should be enforcing? That's the question. The most current one now is vaccines. A lot of people argue for how good vaccines are. I'm not here to debate this at this point, but for sake of argument, let's say yes. Overall, sure, vaccines are good. But is this another position where is it good that the government must enforce? Is it a good that the government must require in order to, say, go to a restaurant? That's the question that we are kind of look at. There's a lot of good things out there, but what role does the government have in playing in these good things? And as a result, what should we be expecting from government in regards to these kind of actions? And I think there's a current mentality that if something is good, the government should do something to enforce it or entice or sway people towards doing that.
Yeah, if they aren't to do it themselves, they should at least push society in that direction.
And that's usually what the role of, you know, fines are for, or our taxes.
Yeah.
Like alcohol, cigarettes, if you purchase either of them, you know how much taxes on there. And it's certainly a consideration, I'm sure, that you make when you purchase those items. And the government has done that in part because they want to make you consider your decisions, at least in the least.
Yeah.
When you're purchasing some of these things. So article number one, kind of in this conversation of everything is good, but is it a good that the government should be doing, or influencing or be involved in? In Newfoundland and Labrador, next year they are going to be introducing Canada's first sugar tax, or at least that's how it's being kind of branded by everyone in the media. What's going to happen there is that a tax is going to be applied on all drinks with added sugars, or at least most of them, at a rate of 20 cents per liter. This will include things that have sugar, corn syrup, fructose. The article says alcoholic beverages are going to be excluded. Apparently they are already taxed enough accordingly. If you're in Newfoundland, you can be you can rest assured your chocolate milk will not be going up, so that's exempt. Your slushies, though, your fountain sodas, those will be caught up in the tax. Here's another one. It says that concentrated drink mixtures, so in cases of concentrates, it says 20 cents per every liter that can be produced will be taxed.
So you buy your little can of the orange juice mix or orange punch mix or whatever you're buying there in your frozen thing, and that's going to get charged at probably 40 cents because it's designed to make 2 liters or whatever one you're buying.
Yeah.
So it's going to add up fast.
Yeah. I wonder if this applies to like powder concentrates.
That just gets dangerous.
Yeah. I got a pretty big lemonade powdered drink mix in my pantry, you know, the Costco variety. And I think it said 320 liters. I think that sounds right. 32 liters seems too small, but maybe it's only 32 liters. No, 32 liters. I bet you it's 32.
That's still a lot. That's
32 liters.
That's a lot.
Yeah. So let's go with 32 liters. At 20 cents, that's adding another $6.40 to a product that probably only costs at most, what, 10 bucks.
Nearly doubling.
Yeah. That's a lot, especially in that. But anyways, even your simple 2-liter Coke is going to cost you an extra 40 cents out in Newfoundland and Labrador starting next year. And all of this is justified or driven by an effort to boost health outcomes, as the article says in the Atlantic CTV News. Their finance minister, Siobhan Cody, says that over half of Newfoundlanders and Labradorian residents over 12 years of age and over have at least one chronic disease, and many people live with more. And then later on in the article, it says, Cody said the goal of the tax is to improve residents' health, and it fits with the government's effort to make Newfoundland and Labrador one of Canada's healthy provinces by 2031. So this tax is designed to change your drinking habits because they want to help you or sway you, influence you to make healthier food decisions or healthier drink decisions. Now, the question is this a good that the government really should be involved in?
That really seems like a personal matter. Your own health, that's your responsibility. But we live in a place where we have public health care. So is your health your own responsibility? Suddenly it's covered by government funding, which is paid for by the taxpayer dollar. So it becomes public. Your health is a public responsibility.
That ends up being one of the trade-offs with public healthcare. But yeah, I think in most cases, people are quick to say that the government has no say in my healthcare or health choices. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
And so, you know, whether I pick up a diet pop or a regular pop, what does that matter to the government? And I think in most cases, it shouldn't. You know, the government doesn't care about what kind of toothpaste I pick out. So why do they care about my soft drink? And so here, I think we have a good, you know, I think it's wise to make good health decisions, you know. If all you're doing is living off of 2 liter Cokes and potato chips, yeah, I don't think that is the best choice, health choices that someone can make. Yeah. I think that's obvious.
Yeah.
And so there is a good. I think there's a good to there is a good here in that we should be making decisions mindful of our health. We should be taking care of our bodies to do things that we desire to be doing. The issue though is, does the government have a role in enforcing those decisions? And you point out that this issue is complicated by the fact that we live in a place of public health care, and as a result, everyone pays for everyone else's health care. And so Canadians are really like going or really like our public health care. You know, we were very proud of it. We certainly have our gripes about many issues of it, but we are proud that we can go to the hospital and not walk away with a huge bill.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, I certainly enjoy that as well. The trade-off though is it does open the door for government to have a justified reason to get involved now, mm-hmm. because now your choice to buy that extra sugary drink leads to more healthcare costs.
Yeah.
Those healthcare costs are not borne by you, or at least by you, or just by you. It's, I am paying for your healthcare choices or consequences of your choices.
Yeah. And it makes it harder on the individual to make the right health choices if they are not responsible, and in more ways responsible for the results. If their healthcare is covered, if they get all the medication they need, if they get all the treatment they need at no expense, it's a lot harder to make those right health choices. Whereas if you are responsible for all outcomes, you have a lot of weight on you to make those right choices. So we're trading off, either the government makes the choices for us or we pay for our own health care.
Yeah. Here, at least on this episode, you know, we're not going to try to solve or discuss the private versus public mm-hmm. side of healthcare, but just to note that public healthcare does come with these consequences for some of these choices that normally would be left up to individuals, but now the government, because the government pays for it, has a say in your choice.
Yeah.
And so again, the topic is, there's a lot of good to be done, but is this a good that the government has to be involved in? And the sugar tax kind of opens up that conversation. Yes, it's good to make healthy choices. What role does the government have in influencing you, charging and doing so by taking more of your money as a result of those yeah. choices? So I we're just presenting these to kind of get you thinking about this idea and what kind of good we expect our government to be doing. The second article relates to the Liberals promised online hate bill. And so what this bill is promising to do is to basically activate social media to alert and report things like hateful speech, terrorist threats, violence, speech that endorses or directs violence, child exploitation. So there's a lot wrapped up in this bill. The main thing here that for this topic is this idea of hate speech. And again, I think we're dealing with something here that we can agree that there is a good here. We should have a society with less hate in it. That would be a better society.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Now the question is, again, what role does the government have in creating that good or bringing that good about. With this bill, now that hateful comment that you see on Facebook or on Twitter, that now as the bill is being or as bill has kind of been through a proposal stage at this point, that includes as the National Post article mentioned refers says that that these proposals for this bill have mandated disclosures to law enforcement, implications for lawful access. They proactively filter your comments, and so there's a lot of privacy. Another part of the article says that the Canadian government risks conscripting the private sector to engage in a form of dragnet surveillance that would have a chilling effect on people's communications and behavior online, and pose risks to their privacy. Now, again, this is, I think, just like the sugar tax, this bill against online hate is designed to change behavior.
Yeah.
Again, I don't think we're in disagreement that that the less hateful speech that's out there, the better. Does the government have a responsibility in policing that, in restricting that, criminalizing that even?
Yeah, that's scary. It seems that, speech is something that traditionally you would confront the person speaking. You would, if somebody says something to you that you find offensive, you tell them that offended you, not have the government get involved.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to go to a different level. It's not not just the threat, but the offense that becomes the crime. I guess that's the question, is the definition of hate speech is where I struggle with these things, is how do you define hate speech? If it's just somebody being offended, where do we go from there? It can become almost anything. And so like it said in here, in order to monitor this, you're pretty much capturing all online activity of everybody in order to monitor for potential hate speech.
Mm-hmm.
It's so broad.
Yeah. That's certainly, I think a topic of conversation is going to be brought up as this bill is later presented. The Liberal government has promised to present this kind of bill in the first 100 days. And so conversations about what or how we define hate speech are definitely going to be something that's going to be discussed, I think, heavily. At the same time, the kind of the objective that we're looking at here, though, is however we want to define hate speech, where does the government's role come in kind of mandating or restricting it or criminalizing mm-hmm. it? Yes, it's good to have a society with less hate speech. Is it the government job to do that good in eliminating hate speech from society? As we go through these articles, you might have already picked it up, I'm not necessarily laying down clean lines of where the threshold is,
yeah.
of where government should be involved, or where it becomes more of a personal choice or community choice in regards to where the government should be stepping in, or where someone else should be doing the good that we're trying to do, that we're aiming at. And I guess as a final example, and just kind of present more of a gray area and to apply this to us locally here in Penhold, I think it's a really interesting case study to kind of look at the difference between the construction of the recent skate park in town and the construction of Critter Corner Playground. That's the brand new one for those who've come up with their own names for these playgrounds.
The new playground?
The new playground, the one on the south end of town, Critter Corner Playground. Now, Critter Corner Playground, it sprang up remarkably fast, like, for as I was kind of following it. It was I think a little over 2 years from the time that it was kind of proposed, or at least the idea of this playground was presented, until the time it was funded and constructed. And as far as the town went, they provided no direct financial contribution, as far as I recall, or as I was researching. They rezoned a certain part of town so they could build the playground, but they didn't have contribute any direct funding. And that was within, like I said, about 2 years. Now, contrast it with the skate park. There have been fundraisers for that for 10 years. And God bless the people that have done that. It is a remarkable example of perseverance.
Yep.
To see those fundraisers out at every community event you can imagine. Selling popcorn or cotton candy or doing raffles. So good on them for their dedication.
Yeah.
My issue isn't with that. What I bring up though is that after 10 years, they still couldn't raise the funds required to build it. And it was only, after the town itself contributed or decided to budget and contribute $150,000 to the building of the skate park. And that ended up being about half the costs of the skate park in total. So my question here is, I'm not going to disagree that it's good to have a skate park in the community. My own kids have enjoyed it for quite a few hours now. But is it a good that the government must pay for? Again, I'm not presenting this as kind of a definitive, here's the line of what good the government should do and what good community groups should do. I present it merely as something to consider as the government, especially as the new council comes on into its service. What are they going to be spending money on, and what criteria are they going to be using? And I would like to think that it's beyond whether or not something is good. If it's good, that doesn't necessarily mean that the government should be paying for it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like I said, it's something for just as a thought. When the government comes in, how do we evaluate what actions they are taking? And I think it has to go beyond whether or not is action A good. Because I don't think every good the government should be involved in.
Yeah, so there's a lot of good that can be done and should be done by charitable organizations or just community groups. There's a lot of tasks and activities that are not necessarily the responsibility of government. Mm-hmm. It's pretty easy to see where government can get too deep into trying to do all good instead of what they may be responsible for.
Yeah, it becomes, I think though, at least in this case, it does become a little more complicated when it's the local government paying for the local projects. I think that's almost, that adds another layer onto the conversation, versus say the federal government spending money on a playground here in Penhold or something like that. I want to see things done as locally as possible,
mm-hmm.
and really with as little government as possible.
Yeah.
And part of that requires them that us as individuals, us as a community, start doing some of these goods. And so just kind of as we wrap up this episode, I just want to kind of highlight some perhaps unintended consequences when the if you will, the wrong people do what is good. And so, yeah, so what I mean is, like I said at the starting, there's good to be done, but not every good has to be done by the government. The follow-up question is, well, then who has to do it? And many times it comes back to us. The individual has to do it, or us, the community, community group, or a charity. We have to take on that responsibility. We can't say we want a smaller government or a less intrusive government without then taking on the responsibility that government themselves are doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some weight that we need to pick up as individuals and community groups in order to take that off of the government.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a package deal. You can't say smaller government and then not be involved in the community.
Yeah.
And so as part of an unintended consequences, I think if someone is doing, or the government is doing, a good that they should not be doing, it means that they are distracted, or at least not fully committed to what good they should be doing. Mm-hmm. So all the spending that gets done towards building a park maybe should have been done towards, you know, repairing the potholes or something like that, which I think is more of a government,
yeah,
obviously a government thing. And then that extra money could be raised through the community. Just a simple example. But just something to think about. If you're doing a good that is not yours to do, then you are taking yourself away from what you should be doing. I think that's pretty straightforward. I think another unintended consequence is that when I do a good that someone else is supposed to be doing, it takes away their responsibility. That is something that they are likely should be doing. And ultimately, I think it leads to a laziness and a dependency. And I think we see that. I think this is obvious, especially on a larger scale.
Yeah, the dependency on government and government resources, funding, and services, I think it becomes pretty apparent.
Yeah, and just to go back to kind of like the online hate bill, and as you mentioned, touched on earlier, I think the responsibility if someone offends us through even hateful speech should not be to go to the government to try to get a bill signed. I think the first step should be us confronting or engaging with the person who's hurt us, who's harmed us, and really use this as an opportunity to build personal relationships. Mm-hmm. When we allow the government to take on all these different responsibilities, all these goods, we lose an opportunity to develop the personal relationships, or deepen our personal relationships with one another. Instead, we kind of outsource our problem solving instead of seeing that as an opportunity to mend fences or grow closer to one another. It takes away opportunities from community groups from forming and bonding together and creating a strong, cohesive society and community around an object like playground. I'm the first to tell you, I enjoy seeing those, you know, child benefit checks in the bank account every week. And yet at the same time, I think we have to be careful that that doesn't produce this kind of laziness, this dependency. I just use that as one example. There's hundreds more that you can think of how government does something that makes your life easier that perhaps you or the community should be doing.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And then I guess lastly, and this kind of builds on what I just last said, that when government intrudes, it breaks down community. We turn to, you know, the premiers, we turn to our elected officials and asking them to solve our problems, when we should be seeing that as an opportunity instead to turn to our neighbors, to turn to our communities, turn to our churches, our charities, and use these as the opportunity to build tighter communities, and I would say more grateful communities.
Yes.
When you receive that kind of anonymous check from the government, that is different than knowing that check that got you through this month came from the local church or from a charity group. Those are done through a much more personal interaction, and I think society is better off when those take place.
Yeah. Yeah, you feel a lot more connected to your community when it's the community that's supporting you, not the government.
So yeah, I hopefully this kind of stirred some thoughts. I'm sure it has for many. So I invite you to kind of leave a comment, send us a message. We're on Facebook, YouTube. You can find us at penholetalkradio.ca. We'd love to get your thoughts and your opinions on this. Where do you draw the limits for government, and where does where does the good that the government should be doing end, and we need to pick up the slack? Or is that even the premise that you agree with? But we'd love to hear from you on this issue and anything else that might spark interest. Thank you again for joining us on this episode. I hope you've perhaps learned something, or we gave you something to think about. My name is Brian Constein.
And I'm Michael Rowland.
And this has been Penhold Talk Radio.